Now, I don't think anyone seriously believes that either white Democrats or white Republicans will give blacks a proportionate share of the action without blacks insisting and taking certain steps to get that. And I think that explains to some degree why at the Gary Convention, the National Black Political Convention at Gary last year, that there were no endorsements of any presidential candidates. That instead, the delegates at that convention wrestled with the larger and more urgent question of a national black political agenda for 1972 and beyond, a program to seize the political power that our presence in America demands. And the preamble of that agenda forcefully announced, and I quote, that the American system does not work for the masses of black people and cannot be made to work without radical, fundamental change initiated by an independent black political force. In other words, that 26-page agenda, which I hope each of you will read, heralded a new black politics. But instead of calling for a bloody revolution, as some critics charged after the convention, the black agenda articulated a revolution of values, a social transformation that would place community before individualism, love before sexual exploitation, a living environment before profits, peace before war, and justice before unjust order, morality before expediency. Now, the black agenda dismissed white politics as dedicated to the preservation of white power, and hence incapable of delivering blacks from the clutches of Babylon. The agenda's 88 recommendations, in effect, the least common denominator of black strivings throughout this nation, included calls for such programmatic items as proportionate black congressional representation. We presently have about 15 black congressmen. We really ought to have about 66 congressmen. And we only have one black senator in the United States Senate, and we ought to have 15. That's just based upon a percentage, the percentage that blacks represent in the total population. That agenda also calls for community control over the police departments throughout this country. It calls for community control over schools and other institutions affecting the lives of black people. It calls for a Bill of Rights for all blacks trapped in the inequities of America's so-called criminal justice system and the release of political prisoners. And we know that our so-called criminal justice system is inherently unjust. All one has to do is to examine the populations of every prison in this country, and you will find that they are disproportionately populated by black people. And I just cannot believe that somehow there is something inherent in black people that causes them to commit more crimes than white. But what I do know is that black people cannot afford good lawyers. They cannot afford the money that it takes that other people use to buy off judges and to do other kinds of things that perhaps if they were brought to the surface would not make our criminal justice system look so pretty. And so that's why they continue to wind up in those hell holes that we call prisons in this country. The agenda also calls for an end to political surveillance of black people by the FBI and the CIA and the Justice Department, and a shift of their attention and their great techniques to ending organized crime and drug traffic in the United States instead. You know, it's very interesting that it came out last year that not the CIA and not the FBI and not the Justice Department, but rather the United States Army had electronic wiretapping and surveillance of some 25,000 American civilians in this country. That is fantastic in a country that is supposed to be free and where people are not supposed to be subject to the so-called Big Brother is watching you phenomenon. That agenda also calls for a Black United Fund to solicit funds from blacks to be used for black charitable and developmental purposes. It calls for black labor unions established parallel to labor unions. I might tell you that it was at this point on that particular item that the Michigan delegation walked out of the convention when the debate came down to the question of whether blacks ought to form their own labor unions because of the fact that, as I said, American organized labor has become so conservative and is unwilling to correct the many injustices that exist with respect to blacks within unions themselves, particularly in the crafts unions. The agenda calls for a federal government guaranteed minimum annual income of $6,500 for a family of four. It calls for free academic and technical education for all blacks up to their highest attainable level. It calls for a national health insurance for all from birth until death, with free medical care for all families with incomes of less than $10,000. It calls for land banks to assure continual black ownership and control of land to be used for cooperative crop production. It calls for black control of communications media in the black community. Do you know that there is not a single television station in the United States of America that is owned by black people? Not a single one. And very few radio stations that are owned by black people. The communications media is one of the most segregated medias in the entire country. Now, I know that most segregated institutions, I know most of you don't believe that because you watch Sanford and Son and you see all those blacks popping up on television. I want you to know that that is a surface situation, and that when you get into the real business of communications, especially the electronic media, that black people are very few and that they do not hold key positions. That agenda finally calls for, and I'm just giving you a few of the things that it calls for, but it also calls for home rule for the District of Columbia, the last community, I suppose, in this nation that has taxation without representation. Now, not only does the National Black Political Agenda sum up major black aspirations and goals, it presents a sort of checklist by which you can evaluate not only white politicians, but black politicians also, and their programs. The Gary Convention ratified that agenda and then set up a permanent apparatus to bring about its implementation in 1972 and beyond. It established a steering committee that was empowered to establish a national black political assembly consisting of 427 members, or one for every 10 delegates who originally went to the convention. And that assembly will include Democrats, Republicans, separatists, integrationists, in general, a cross-section of regions, ideologies, and interest groups in that assembly, and it will function like a congressional body. But it will also endorse candidates, it will support candidates, it will run national voter registration drives, it will lobby for black issues, it will assess black progress, and it will make recommendations to the national convention. And another national convention is being planned in 2 years, within 2 years. The National Assembly will be an issue-oriented focal point of black politics, hopefully in the United States of America. It could be a chief brokerage operation for dealing with white political institutions. The Assembly and the Black Agenda were the two most important achievements of the Gary Convention, aside from the minor miracle of so many diverse elements of black America coming together on 6 weeks' notice, getting to know each other and maintaining at least a surface unity. Now, much of the national press after that convention headlined the erroneous impression that the convention's most significant issues and the two issues which dominated the convention were the anti-busing resolution and the resolution calling for the dismantling of Israel. Now, that's just not the fact, and anyone that was there knows that that is not the fact and knows that those two resolutions came very late in the last day of the convention when there were not very many people left on the floor of the assembly, but that many other things had been considered, debated, and approved prior to those two matters coming up. And the fact is that the national media, in its effort to portray those two issues as the only things considered, I think, function in a predictable manner. It acted in the way that it felt would bring the most discredit to that convention. The Gary Convention presented abundant evidence that increasing numbers of blacks will follow political paths which are independent of the two major parties. That doesn't mean that they won't participate in the two major parties. It simply means that as a matter of priority, they will participate in the black political movement or the black political thrust. And the full impact of that historic meeting in Gary will probably not be known for many years to come. Indeed, the remainder of this decade may be required to assess the effectiveness of this newest effort towards mobilizing the national black electorate. But already it is clear that Gary set black politics apart from the bankrupt American tradition. The convention repudiated the existing American politics of smoke-filled rooms, of under-the-table deals, of corruption and fraud, of selling boatloads of black people down the river. It is too early to know whether Gary can be seen as a bright beacon, which flared briefly and then went out. But nevertheless, the revolution in political, economic, and social values that it proposes have profound implications for a new political order in this country. It may be beaten back this time or even the next, but ultimately, it is difficult to see how black or white politics in America can ever be the same again. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm told we have about 15 minutes for questions. Yes. Well, of course it is. But I think I ought to point out to you that blacks attempted to be engaged in the politics of coalition back in the 60s. But the kinds of coalitions that were formed always had whites leading and blacks playing a subjugated role. And what we are suggesting is that those kinds of coalitions may work for other people, but they don't work for black people. And so today, what blacks must first do, I think, is to organize themselves. They must solidify their own unity in order to be in a position to negotiate with other groups who, as you say, are also oppressed, to negotiate coalitions that will have blacks occupying leadership roles as opposed to the kinds of roles they played in the days when, for example, a president of the NAACP was never no one ever thought about making the president of a national president of the NAACP black. He was always white. So, you know, that kind of coalition just does not work, clearly does not work for black people. And in order to force those kinds of coalitions, that is where blacks play leadership roles, they must be strong themselves. They must have total control of their own resources. They must have black people registered and organize in every community. And right here, you know, in this school, I want to point out something because one young man up at Princeton a couple weeks ago asked me, he said, Mayor Hatcher, what can we do? There's just 150 black people here at Princeton. What can we do? And I told him this. I said, if you would organize a political unit made up of 150 black students on this campus, and if that unit initiated communications with blacks on other campuses all over this country, pretty soon you would have a very solid and strong network of political organizations that could address itself to some of the important issues of this day, and be able to take some collective action in that regard. And I would suggest that if that is true at Princeton, where they only have 150 black students, it is much more true at the University of Illinois, where I understand there are over 2,000 black students. It is very important that students organize and that they be in a position to tie in. For example, there is a state black caucus in the state of Illinois, and there ought to be some unit here on this campus that ties into that state black caucus, which in turn ties into the National Assembly. Now, I say that we must be strong. Because very frankly, you know, no coalition is workable unless you bring something to it. And so black people must bring something. Then they are in a position to negotiate, as I said, with other groups that are oppressed, whether that is young people, whether that is women, whether that is Latinos, whoever. It means that you must be in a position to forge a coalition that is going to be a strong coalition. Yes.
Attention.
Well, I think that, first of all, I would say that much of what Mr. Cockrell says is correct. That is that some people did, in fact, leave Gary rushing to Miami in order to, in effect, negotiate what they saw as, or act as a power broker with the white establishment in that, you know, in the Democratic Party. Now, I'm just not aware of anybody that left Gary and went to the Republican convention and thought that they were negotiating anything there. But that is true that some did. But I think, you know, one of the serious problems I have with that is that it is a general indictment of everyone that was at Gary and everything that happened. And while I think it's probably correct as it applies to certain people, it's certainly not correct as it applies to everyone that was at Gary, and particularly those who have followed up on Gary, who have who are now participating in the National Black Political Council, in the National Black Political Assembly, which just met, I might say, this past weekend in Detroit, and those who are active as members of committees and so on within the organizational and structural framework. I think that it is not true, for example, that the black vote was like sold in this last election. I think what was true was that a choice was made between, you know, what was considered the old, you know, lesser of two evils approach, and the choice, the decision was that there were really three things that black people could have done in this past November. One, they could have supported Mr. Nixon. Two, they could have supported Mr. McGovern. Or three, they could have supported no one, just stayed home. And for me, the third alternative is unacceptable, because I think what, rather than less participation in the political process, I think we need to participate more. To me, the first alternative was unacceptable. That is Mr. Nixon. And so it left, you know, most of us with Mr. McGovern, whom we did support. And I don't see that as a kind of selling out. I think that in terms of realistic politics, that what you try to do is, you know, and someone, I think Julian Bond or someone has said that politics is the art or science of getting who gets what and how much. And I think that's what you really have to do if you're going to be involved in the electoral system at all. You have to figure out how to get, you know, as much as you can for black people. And in that sense, I think it was absolutely proper to try to support the candidate and the party that you stood to gain the most from, even though that most might be far from everything that you wanted or far from perfection. So in that sense, you know, I don't see that, you know, I think anytime you're involved politically, you're involved in some kind of compromise. I think that is just a reality. And as I said, what Gary really means, I think it's too early to determine what Gary, you know, really meant and what it will mean. But I do know that there are many people who still, and, you know, have a very strong belief in what Gary was all about, and who are, in their own way, doing their best to carry out the mandate of, you know, those 10,000 black people coming together there. And I think rather than, you know, having that, needing someone to sort of tell you, well, look, you know, it didn't work out, what we really need are people to participate. I'll tell you one thing that has happened, and you know, this may sound like an indictment of black elected officials, and it is, of some, but not all. But black elected officials have tended not to participate in the follow-up mechanism to the extent that I think they should. And as a result, have become very upset because many people who identify themselves as cultural nationalists have assumed rather dominant roles, you know, in that structure. But I don't know what else they can expect if they don't you know, choose to become involved and to participate. And I think we're seeing a little, you know, we're overcoming that a little now because we're seeing, you know, more black elected officials now are coming back to, because they were all at Gary, a lot of them were at Gary, but they're now coming back to the structure itself, that is to the assembly. And I think that's very important.
Okay, yes.
Yes. Fine, sure.
The drug problem within Gary is, you know, very bad, especially the drug war, like 20 people killed last year.
Right.
I think a few killed already this year.
Three. Well, you know, my first answer to that is that there's not a city in the country, including Gary, that I'm aware of, that they manufacture heroin. You know, we don't manufacture heroin in Gary. We don't manufacture cocaine in Gary. It all comes from outside the city, all right? And I think the other point that I would make is, and what I really mean by that is that a city like Gary or Chicago or Champaign or any place else is not going to solve it's not going to be able to solve the drug problem, quote unquote. It's going to have to be solved by the national government taking a position, and I don't mean by giving millions of dollars to Turkey not to plant poppy seeds either. It's going to have to be solved at the national level. And, you know, I just can't believe with the kind of sophistication, you know, Senator Stennis was shot. And, you know, there are crimes all over this country that go unsolved, you know, period. But Senator Stennis was shot, and they came up with the three people that they say did it, you know. And that's because they wanted to, and because the FBI, you know, put, like, its best talent to work. And I can't believe with that kind of talent in the FBI and their ability when they wanted to, you know, the kind of expertise displayed at Watergate, you know, by certain federal people. I just can't believe they can't find out who the major pushers of drugs in this country are. They can't find out how it's coming into the country. And my point is that I think that the only reason we're getting a little more concerned, for example, in Gary now, there's a federal task force in that area now that has been doing a lot of work. And to be very frank with you, contrary to much of what you have read, that drug situation in Gary has just cooled off considerably. As a matter of fact, and people always laugh when I say this, but really for 11 months in a row, Gary has had a decline in its overall crime rate. I know that's kind of hard to believe, you know, after what you read, but that is just a fact. And it has cooled off considerably. But the federal, I think the only reason now you're getting some involvement on the part of the federal government, if you notice, President Nixon cut a lot of other things in his fiscal 74 budget, but he increased the money for fighting drugs, for the drug problem. And I think it's only because the problem clearly is no longer confined to the black community. You know, the black community is saturated with it, but it's not confined there. And it is now spreading and has spread, you know, to suburban areas. And so, of course, there is national concern about it now. And, you know, I think that that is just the way it is. But the fact is that if drugs, for example, what happens in the black community with drugs, is, and I'm talking about hard drugs. I'm not talking about marijuana. I'm talking about heroin, cocaine, and so on. And I've seen this over and over again. It really destroys, it just literally destroys, the potential for some fantastic contributions that young black people could make to a community. It just destroys that. And that is, as I was saying, that's just a form, that's to me, that's a form of genocide. I think there are a lot of ways of ripping people off, and I think the drug thing is just one of them. And I think that we're just fortunate, as I said, that it has spread now to the white community, because finally there is some note being taken. And there's going to have to be action at the national level in order to solve the problem of drugs. We have done what we can do at the local level, and as I said, we've been able to contain it to some degree, but we certainly haven't been able to solve it. Yes. Let me tell you. Hold it. Now wait a minute. Don't misunderstand me. Frankly, a non-addicted pusher, I don't think anything is too bad, you know, in terms of doing. In fact, I'd like to personally execute sentence with respect to a few of them, because what they are doing to young people, you know, in this country is just incredible. So don't misunderstand me when I say I don't agree, you know, with him about instituting the death penalty. What I do know, though, is as a result of every study that I've ever seen of the effect of the death penalty, first of all, it doesn't work the way he says it's going to work. It does not act as a deterrent. As a matter of fact, in those states which have eliminated the death penalty, you find that there is less, you know, there are fewer major crimes in those states than there are in states which have it, such as Indiana, which, you know, still has the electric chair. So, you know, it just hasn't been something that works. And then finally, I would say this. I just, you know, philosophically do not believe in the death penalty. Being a lawyer, I know how imperfect our criminal justice system is, and I know how many innocent people get convicted. And if you have the death penalty, you may find out 5 years later that it was the wrong man, but it's too late then. You know, whereas if, you know, he's still in prison, at least something can be done. So that's another reason why I'm opposed. And as I said, just on the basis of, just in terms of the right to take another life, you know, I don't believe really that anyone has the right to take another's life, except, you know, the possible situation may be self-defense. I think, you know, there, but I think the one place in terms of my own feeling and my own philosophy that I would really weaken would be where it comes to the non-addicted pusher. I just have no kind words or good feelings whatsoever for that person. I just think that they are profiting off the misery and the despair of other people, and what they are doing is so permanent. You know, I know very few people who have been able to shake the drug habit. I mean, permanently. Very few people, you know, in our community. And I suspect that the same is true nationally. And I just have no sympathy for anybody that, you know. But for the reasons I mentioned, I don't agree with the president. Yes. Yes. Well, I think the main reason that I have for being optimistic is that I'm alive, you know, and as long as I'm alive, you know, I've got to be optimistic.
Yeah,
but beyond that, I think that, you know, you have to recognize a couple of things. In Gary, for example, for many years, the black community in Gary always voted, you know, for the Democratic Party, and they elected candidates, white candidates, to mayor and all kinds of other offices, and, you know, they never got anything, nothing ever happened. And then, you know, like one day somebody woke up and said, gee, you know, the same votes that we cast for them, we can cast for one of our own and elect one of our own. And so they did, and the result of that is that they've been able to gain a degree of political power in that community and do certain things and alleviate to some degree the conditions under which they were living. Now, I'm saying to you that at the national level, we have not been utilizing one of the levers that are available to us to a maximum degree, and that is political organization and participation in the electoral process. As long as blacks simply go to the polls and vote for somebody, You're right. You know, there's no reason to be optimistic because, you know, if they have no way of exerting pressure. But what is happening, I think, in the last few years is that blacks have been organizing and have begun to insist upon participation in policymaking of the national parties. And, you know, I think that is a limited, it is a halting, it is a groping, you know, phenomenon at this point, but it is a growing one. Now, I want to make one thing clear. I talk a lot about electoral politics because it happens, one, that I'm involved in that, and I think I know a little about what is taking place there. But the other thing is that, you know, I see that, as I said, as one of the things we can do. I don't want anyone to get the impression that that is like the exclusive way and the exclusive kind of thing that black people ought to be doing right now, or that that represents the ultimate. That is, like, if you can go out and elect a black mayor, that you have really made it, because you haven't. You know, take my word for it. As I pointed out earlier, the U.S. Steel still runs some 28,000 jobs in Gary. Blacks don't sit on the banks, on the boards of the major banks or financial institutions in that community. So we still have a lot to do, even though we have a lot of political power. So what I am saying is that there are many ways and many things that black people ought to be doing right now. They ought to be getting very deeply involved in the whole economic process in this country. Because in addition to it being the country is not only racist, but the country is also, in a sense, it discriminates in terms of class, in terms of economic class. And I think that's, you know, probably something that doesn't even need to be said. It's so clear that it does. And so we have to be involved and understand how our economic system works and figure out how to get the most out of that economic system as well as the political system. And the one can help the other. And I see that as very important. Now, you talk about the 14%, or, you know, those are your figures. You know, I think it's more like 17%, you know, or maybe even 20%, but, you know, we'll never know from the Bureau of the Census, of course. But how do we take that, which is obviously a minority, whatever the percentage is, and how do we convert that into some semblance of political power? Well, I think, obviously, blacks have to play coalition politics. And I think what is happening today is that not only are blacks becoming more conscious, but other groups within the society are becoming more conscious. For example, I think white students in this country didn't really believe they would do it to them until Kent State happened. You know, they believed that the only students that got shot were black students until Kent State happened. And then they found out at Kent State, you know, that when things go down, if you're on the wrong side of the fence, that the bullets are for you too. And so it seems to me that's politicized a large number of white youth in this country. And we may not see it, you know, it may not be focused and crystallized at this point, but I think it's something that's happening. A few years ago, you know, there was the white radical student movement was in the hands of maybe just a handful of people in the whole country. But that movement grew. It really grew until, you know, like in the late 60s and really 70, 71, it really, a lot of things happened because it was there. I think that kind of growth will develop in terms of whites becoming very conscious of what has happened. For example, on these budget cuts that the president has engaged in, actually, I wonder, where are the white liberals on that? Because the fact is that even though blacks are going to be hurt disproportionately by those cuts, three out of every four people who will be affected by those cuts are whites, not blacks. And so I think, you know, once that kind of sinks in, I think you will begin to see the kind of coalitions developing that will make it possible, you know, that will give the numbers that are necessary in order to have an impact. One more, and then we'll quit. Okay. But I want to say one thing about that. First of all, I am really concerned about black women participating in the so-called Women's Lib movement. And let me tell you why. I'm not anti-women or whatever, you know, because, you know, in our administration, you know, some of my best friends are women. Say that. But here's why I'm really concerned about black women, you know, becoming so caught up in the women's lib movement, so-called women's lib movement. First of all, that is basically a middle-class white movement. You know, from the very beginning, that's what it has been. And no one's ever, you know, pretended that it was anything else. And I would defy any black woman to tell me that she has received mistreatment and maltreatment, more mistreatment and maltreatment as a result of her being a woman than she has as a result of her being black. And so it seems to me, just in terms of priorities, what black women must be about is the business of black liberation. And that women's liberation, you know, is important, but it is going to have to take like a, you know, a back seat to that. And I, you know, personally, that's just, I know I will be kind of cut down by Bella Abzug and some of my other friends, but that's the way I feel. Thank you very much.
1 minute, hey. Hey, there's gonna be a reception. There's gonna be a reception at LAR.